Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solver.
Just a reminder that this podcast is intended to be purely educational and is not meant as medical advice. Any patient information has been modified to protect the patient's identity. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers.
Enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome back to another session of the Rafa Medina subspecialty VMR. And today our focus will be on nephrology. And for this, we have two guests. As a case discussant, we have Dr. J. Radhakrishnan. Dr. J. is a professor of medicine at Columbia University Medical Center in New York. He is a director of clinical services of the nephrology division, and his clinical and research interests are in the therapy of chronic kidney disease, hypertension, and intensive care nephrology. Beyond that, he is a fellow of the American Society of Nephrology and National Kidney Foundation. His commitment to medical education and patient care is exemplified by numerous teaching awards and his inclusion in the Who's Who among America's Teachers and Educators, America's Best Doctors, and Castle Connolly's Top Doctor. And as a case presenter, we have Maddie Abrams, who is an internal medicine PGY1 and an aspiring cardiologist at Columbia Med at New York Presbyterian Hospital. And she graduated last year at Zucker School of Medicine. And before jumping into the case, I would like to ask both of you, could you please introduce yourself and also share with us why you chose internal medicine and what you like to do outside of medicine beyond that?
Maddie, you're on.
I'm first. All right. Well, hi, everyone. It's nice to meet you all virtually. Why did I choose internal medicine? That's a hard question. I feel like I'm in my internal medicine interviews. I think, you know, for me, there were a few things. The first is that I loved the way that physiology played into clinical medicine. I loved that you could think through clinical problems from like a physiologic mindset and be able to solve those problems, you know, by kind of digging down into the science that we know underlying everything. And I also, you know, I know I want to do cardiology, but I wanted to be able to train broadly for a few more years. You know, I didn't want to just jump in so narrowly. I love medicine and I wanted the opportunity to really sort of think about the human body as a whole, especially because even when you do focus on a single system, every system is interrelated. So that's why I chose internal medicine. And things I like to do outside of work are for fun. I really love sports. So I love watching sports, playing sports. So yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Yeah, I'm J. Radhakrishnan. I've been here at Columbia University Medical Center for about 30 years. You can see in the gray, right? So what brought me into medicine and then nephrology, essentially a challenge that every patient is different and every patient is a learning process for the next patient, right? And I think that's not even, you know, despite 40 plus years in the business, I still find it amazing that there's still things I don't know. I still need to ask people and read up. And that's the best thing I think I like about this whole medicine going through nephrology. And nephrology is interesting because I think it's the most abstract part of medicine. And you really got to sort of work your way through problems. Many of them are mathematical, which I like, right? So it's a lot of fun. And we work very closely with the pathologists because, you know, every glomerular patient, for example, ends up with a biopsy. And we combine our sort of unique skills, clinical and, you know, path skills to come to a diagnosis. And then you look at the evidence, devise the treatment plan, which is, you know, very interesting because I sit on part of the guideline committee for glomerular disease. And even now we battle out, you know, unlike cardiology where heart failure is, you know, too tried and true, treat to target. In glomerular disease, there are a lot of nuances, which really have to have a discussion with patients before we come to a final plan. So outside of nephrology, this might seem a little weird, but I practice a martial art called Asian Ryu Aikido, which is, you can look it up. It's kind of difficult to explain what it is. Okay, so that's me. And I welcome you all, and hopefully it'll be an interesting session.
Thank you so much for being here. I also remember from one nephrology session, I think it was Dr. Letizia sharing with us that the kidneys are the washing machines of the human body. And I really agree with you that nephrology is superb. Okay, whenever described, ready, then I would say, Maddie, could you please share the first aliquot with us?
I will indeed. So I will preface this by saying, though, that despite this being a nephrology case, the first aliquot might not seem like it is. So you have to use a little bit of creativity in thinking maybe how this chief complaint might tie itself into nephrology, because the chief complaint is headache and blurry vision. Plot twist indeed.
So, Dr. J, what comes into your mind if you see these chief complaints?
So, you know, assuming it's not nephrology, right? Let's someone walks in the emergency room. Could he give me at least an idea of age? How old is the patient?
28-year-old female.
Okay, young woman comes into the emergency room and gather with a headache and blurry vision. You always begin by wondering if there's an, you know, intracranial process going on. We have to obviously look into how acute this is. Is it chronic or acute? Is there a past history of these things, these symptoms? Is it a brand new, you know, presentation of a completely healthy person who suddenly presented with this? But the list is long, as you can imagine. So intracranial process, malignant hypertension, and so on. I think we have very, very broad brushstrokes. And I think a detailed history and a quick exam to make sure that the patient's not bleeding in the head, I think is really emergent right now.
Amazing. And when it comes to blurry vision, how would you connect a headache with blurry vision together?
Right. So the eyes is the window of the CNS, right? So if you look at processes that causes blurry vision, now she didn't say there's a loss of vision. She just said it's a little blurry, which implies that her retina is not perceiving light, 100%. So this could easily be a classic presentation of malignant hypertension. We've had patients with vasculitis, but, you know, the age is important. So you have an older patient, say a 70-year-old person with these symptoms. PMR, large vessel vasculitis is an important differential.
Thank you so much. Then, Maddie, could you please go ahead?
Yeah, sure. So this is a 28-year-old female. I guess I'm sort of going a little bit into the past medical history, but she has a history of hypertension. She has PCOS and a report of recurrent UTIs. And so she presented with the above chief complaint of headache and blurry vision. She was actually awakened with a severe headache. She wasn't awakened from sleep by the headache, but she woke up with the headache. She describes it as a diffuse headache, and it's worse when she's lying flat. There's no dizziness, no lightheadedness, no focal weakness or numbness. And it's associated with bilateral blurred vision, no double vision, just blurred vision. But she's also feeling nauseous, felt like she had to vomit, no episodes of vomiting. The rest of her review systems is pretty much negative. So she doesn't have any fevers, no chills. She doesn't have any diarrhea, doesn't have any abdominal pain, no dysuria, no hematuria, no increased frequency of urination, no urinary urgency either. And the one thing I'll add to the HPI without disclosing too much, so I was told a little bit more in the presentation, but for the sake of making this interesting, I won't say too much, is that she actually had a similar presentation to a different hospital a few months prior.
Amazing. So, Dr. J, does these new information give you any hints, or does it narrow down your differential right now?
No. So I think she's not previously healthy. I think that's the first order of business, right? So she has known hypertension, and she, If you had told me that she had never presented with headache ever before, I think an intracranial acute emergency, I think, is the most important thing to rule out, because that can be life-saving if you step in early. But in her case, she's hypertensive. She's had the exact same presentation a few months ago. Presumably she was treated, came out of it. So I think the top in my list would be a malignant hypertension as the main differential in this list. Of course, I'm assuming she was not discharged on immunosuppressive agents and just probably antihypertensive. So if that's the case, I would, still use malignant hypertension as my number one diagnosis.
What I would like to ask you is, we see that this is a 28-year-old female. This is a pretty young age for someone presenting with hypertension. When you're tackling, the causes for hypertension, how would you approach this, especially in a young person?
Right. So when you look at how do you work up a hypertension? I think the key is you have to sniff out secondary causes, right? So this is a classic case where you won't just assume it's essential hypertension. Even in such a presentation, maybe 5 or 10% would have a secondary cause, down from, say, 1 to 2%. But the idea is that this patient, if indeed there's nothing else going on but hypertension, would have a very, very detailed workup for causes of secondary hypertension. And we can talk about that list depending on how this case evolves, right?
Okay, awesome. Then, Maddie, can you please share further details?
Yes. So I mentioned hypertension history, history of PCOS. And then the only other thing I mentioned is that she has a history of recurrent UTIs. She's had 4 or 5 in the past year. In terms of her surgical history, no surgeries in the past. In terms of the medications that she takes, so I will say that she was prescribed an antihypertensive when she was discharged from the hospital the last time, but she hasn't been taken. She takes oral contraceptives for her PCOS. And then the one thing I will say is that for her UTIs, she actually says that she is prescribed fluconazole for her UTIs. So questionable if they're UTIs versus something else.
Can I just make a comment on that? So in the community, a lot of times, you know, people present for a routine health, you know, health physical. And then some, you do a urinalysis with a dipstick. It shows red cells, white cells, and a little bit of protein, right? So they always get presumed UTI treatment, but, and there's no follow up to know if it's true. So if this patient had a true UTI with symptoms and a culture, you'd have said it's likely UTI, but asymptomatic proteinuria or hematuria can sometimes be ascribed to UTI. And basically we're missing the opportunity to basically rule out a kidney issue. For example, IgA nephropathy and, you know, other chronic smoldering glomerular disease, which goes on for many years. And until you hit some sort of a bump in the road, typically hypertension, and that exacerbates the glomerular disease, which then causes more hypertension and the cycle keeps, you know, moving on and on, right? So it's important to, when you look at this history of recurrent UTI, especially if it's recent, you need to be sure it's a real UTI and not just a dipstick positive, you know, test that leads to treatment for a presumptive UTI.
And another thing is, in terms of the use of oral contraceptives, there was also someone commenting whether this could increase any, you know, risk for any hypercoagulable state. Do you think that we should think of it, or do you say that this is more like noise or than a signal in this case?
To call it a hypercoagulable state, you have to document coagulation, right? So and usually it's, you know, so this patient was, we don't have enough data yet. Is this a cerebral sort of vascular cavernous sinus thrombosis or something? That'll change the whole, you know, obviously discussion. But at this point in time, there's no documentation that there is a hypercoagulable state because she has no focal deficits. There's no signs of any clot peripherally, right? So as the case evolves, we can discuss that. But clearly at this point, it's not a hypercoagulable state based on given data.
And another question regarding her recurrent UTIs. Is there anything like any diseases or something that could be a clue for something like recurrent UTIs? Like when I think of recurrent UTIs, especially if it was a younger patient, I would have thought of someone presenting with like a diabetic state, like someone who has so much glucosuria or taking SGLT2 inhibitors. Is there anything else that could come into your mind?
So if this is UTI, she's been completely asymptomatic for her entire childhood and early adulthood, and suddenly the UTI start. It's not unusual in women of childbearing age to get recurrent UTI. It's very common. But if this patient was younger, premenopausal, then we need to look for structural defects in the urinary tract, and the most common being reflux, right? But again, just a few UTIs, it qualifies for recurrent. It does mean that you have to culture the patient, know that she's been treated appropriately, not with fluconazole, but with an appropriate antibiotic, right? And then if it comes back, then she'd need a whole urologic workup, including, you know, looking if it's multi-organisms, you can look for a fixed fistula, a rectovesicular fistula. You can look for a missed reflux. You can get reflux that is mild and can present very rarely, but it's known to happen in young adulthood. Or you look for, say, a bladder diverticulum, you know, some problems with the urinary tract, right? That's leading to UTIs. So it's a whole other discussion. The workup for recurrent UTIs is quite extensive, depending on the nature of the organism and how difficult and how recurrent it is, right?
Thank you so much. Maddie, could you please share an anecdotic one?
Yes. So for the rest of this one, family history, really, really nothing. Social history, nothing significant. No real toxic habits. So no smoking, you know, no recreational drugs. I think drink socially. Not currently sexually active. And allergies-wise, no known drug allergies.
Do you know what medications she was prescribed at the time of discharge? Do you have that on you?
Yes. She was prescribed nifedipine.
Nifedipine alone. Okay. We'll come back to that, at the end of the talk, saying what is the appropriate initial antihypertensive rate based on your patient's profile?
So, Dr. Day, is anything of these new information giving you more ideas of what is going on in this case?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we have two signals, right? One is new onset, or I'm going to say uncontrolled hypertension. There's an adherence problem taking blood pressure meds. So he's probably coming twice with uncontrolled hypertension. The recurrent UTIs, as I said, is a red flag for typically a glomerular disease. So you want to be sure that we're not missing a glomerular disease this time by wrongly ascribing it a UTI diagnosis to an abnormal urine sediment. So we have to be a little more circumspect in now working up the case to the fullest, trying to explain why these episodes are happening. And can we explain the urine abnormalities based on a little more extensive exam, including a microscopic exam of the urine? And of course, protein to creatinine ratio.
Amazing. Well, I also wanted to ask, because you mentioned malignant hypertension, when we talk about malignant hypertension versus hypertensive crisis, how do we differentiate between these both?
Yeah, very good question. So there's urgency and there's emergency, right? An emergency means if you do not bring the blood pressure down in a few hours, you lose organ function or life, right? And there are very well defined true medical emergencies going from head to toe, a cerebrovascular accident. You have malignant hypertension with ocular damage. You have in the chest, dissecting aneurysm. You have an acute coronary syndrome, pulmonary edema. You have an aortic aneurysm. You have acute renal failure from hypertension. You have preeclampsia, eclampsia, right? These are some of the things I can remember. Urgency, on the other hand, is you have a few days. So most urgent hypertension is basically above a stage 2 hypertension, typically, you know, in the high hundreds to low 200s, but without any sign of organ dysfunction. And such patients you can actually treat as an outpatient, as long as you can be assured that the patient's going to come back next day and the following day when you start your antihypertensive regimen. If you're not confident that the patient's going to return, you better admit them to bring the blood pressure down and control them as an inpatient. Any patient who presents with malignant or urgent hypertension should be worked up for a secondary cause, okay? Because your pre-test probability is approximately 3 to 4 times that of someone with stage 1 or stage 2 hypertension.
Thank you so much. And when it comes to the management of someone presenting with malignant hypertension, how would you go forward with this kind of patient?
Right. So the key is to obviously define what organ is at risk, right? So, and each organ has its own, you know, management, paradigm. For example, if it's preeclampsia, eclampsia, you want to deliver the child as quickly as possible. With the dissecting aneurysm, you know, prepare for surgery, put them on a nitroprusside or a drip and with a beta blocker, right? To slow the heart rate and reduce wall stress. If it's a CVA, you got to prepare for urgent thrombectomy, or if it's an aneurysm that's ruptured, you know, surgical or endovascular ablation, and so on, right? But if everything is under control and all you're having is, you know, hypertensive retinopathy with, say, PRESS or other directly, you know, ascribed blood pressure related organ damage, then you know, bring down the blood pressure by 25%. With parenteral medications, and off late, the drug that we're using, which is very useful, is nicardipine. You know, the onset and offset is very quick. There's no side effects. And we preferentially use it in, say, subarach hemorrhage to avoid the vasospasm in the brain, right? Other drugs, if nicardipine is not available, nitroprusside is very widely available, but you got to be a little careful because you cannot give in kidney failure because thiocyanate is the cumulative compound. Can lead to cyanide poisoning, but it's very effective and very quick onset and offset. And then again, based on if it's pulmonary edema, you like nitroglycerin because it has preload reducing effects as well as afterload, IV nitroglycerin. We can use a beta blocker, as we mentioned, in the setting of acute coronary syndrome. And then you add on other medications after your heart rate is controlled. So this is just a broad overview. My reference is that if you look at the American Heart Association guideline on management of hypertension. It has all of these in about 80 pages, right? Including the choice of drugs and everything. So it's a very important reference, and everyone who's practicing medicine should read that document.
Thank you so much for sharing all these pearls. Maddie, could you share the next article?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So vital signs. Temperature was 37 Celsius. For those who do not know Celsius, that is 98.6 Fahrenheit. Heart rate was 104. Blood pressure was 222 over 146. And respiratory rate was 18%. And she was sitting 100% on room air. For the
Can
rest.
Can I just make one comment before?
Yeah.
So if you see this combination of tachycardia with extreme high blood pressure, there's something odd right away. Because you learn from physiology, if you raise blood pressure, what happens to heart rate? To go down, right? There's a, I can't remember the name of the law. Because you young person should be able to tell us it's a law, right? So when you see a heart rate that's inappropriately elevated, there are a couple of things you need to think of. One is pheochromocytoma, right? That's one. The second is heart failure. And you can see this also with dysautonomias, right? For example, if a patient has a spinal cord transection, you can get this discordance of heart rate and blood pressure. So these are some thoughts when someone comes with a high heart rate in the setting of high blood pressure.
Thanks a lot. Maddie, could you share the rest of the exam?
Sure, no problem. So general appearance, she was sitting up in bed, really not any, no acute distress. Her HENT exam. So I will skip to the fundoscopic exam, which full disclosure, I certainly did not do. Left that to the our ophthalmology colleagues. But the fundoscopic exam, as per them, showed disc hemorrhages, cotton wool spots, and flame hemorrhages. So straight out of first aid. And then the rest of her exam was pretty much okay. Her cardiovascular exam, she was, you know, borderline tachycardic, no murmurs. Her lungs were clear, no wheezes, no rails, no ronchi. Her belly was soft. It was non-tender. No masses appreciated.
Was it papilledema?
No comment on papilledema, actually.
So it's just hemorrhages and...
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
So I guess the key question is, and maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, is this a vasculitic picture or is it a malignant hypertension picture, or is it up to me to decide?
That's you.
Okay, I get it. So just to give you an idea of hypertensive retinopathy, right? So if you look at the two types, one is acute and one's chronic. So if you look at chronic, as a consequence of longstanding hypertension, and you see the same changes in every organ in the body, the kidney, the brain, the eyes, you get what's called progressive sclerosis, right? So the lumen of the blood vessel gets narrower and narrower because of medial thickening and laying down of fibrotic matrix in the media. And over time, it gets from what we call bronzing. I can't remember the exact name, but KWB1234. So essentially, as you get narrower and narrower, it goes from a golden color to a silver color to occlusion, right? But as acutely, it's different because you're basically glowing out the endothelium. When the endothelium is not working, two things happen, right? One is you get occlusion, so you get areas of closure. And the second is you leak out blood, which is hemorrhages, and you leak out protein, which is exudates. So both hard exudates, which is essentially occlusion and infarct, and soft exudates, which is protein leakage, and you have hemorrhage. And this is all in the distribution of the small vessels, right? And finally, you have papilledema, which is the most advanced grade of hypertensive retinopathy. So you can basically not have papilledema, but still have very dramatic changes in the retina from hypertension alone without invoking a vasculopathy, because it is a vasculopathy, to a secondary vasculopathy.
Amazing reasoning sharing. As you said, we were thinking of a secondary cause, or you also shared with us in terms of our vitals, you were thinking of, as you said, something like pheochromocytoma. I would also ask you, like, in this kind of case, can we also speak of something like sympathomimetic toxicity, since you would expect more, as you said, a lower heart rate to see this kind of blood pressure?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, you know, if you take cocaine or ephedrine poisoning, right, you can get exactly the similar presentation. You can have a high heart rate because it's a non-specific stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system.
Thank you so much. Then, Maddie, could you please share the next aliquot as well?
Yes, absolutely. I'll finish out the last two parts of the exam just because they may or may not be important. But neuro was non-focal other than the eye exam that I mentioned. Really nothing significant. And then the extremity exam, the one thing that I will mention that may or may not be significant is that she had no lower extremity edema. In terms of the labs, So I'll start with her admission labs, because as I'm sure you can suspect, there's going to be a workup that follows. But in terms of her admission labs, so her white blood cell count was 11.14. Hemoglobin was 8.1. And I'll say that the MCV was 91, so it was a normocytic. And then the platelets was were 81. Okay. In terms of the chemistry, so sodium was 139. Potassium was 3.5, chloride 96, bicarb 23, BUN was 91, and creatinine was 16.93. Glucose was 98, calcium was 8.6, FOS was 7.0, and magnesium was 2.9. And then for the liver test, so AST was 12, ALT was 13, ALK-FOS 87, T-Billy 0.3, and albumin was 4.1.
Wow, we got some amazing labs. So, Dr. J, I would now ask you, is this giving you more clues of this case?
Yeah, it's. I think it's a pretty sort of interesting problem. So just to look at the hemogram, right? So low platelets and anemia with normal white, slightly high white count is what's striking. So when you look at a low platelets with such advanced kidney disease, right, in the setting of a very high blood pressure, okay, so the thing that we need to rule out is what is thrombotic microangiopathy. Now we come to the problem of not macro, but microthrombosis, right? And so what is this? So thrombotic microangiopathy is essentially microvascular occlusion with fibrin and platelets because of endothelial activation. And that lead to occlusion and then organ ischemia, could be kidney failure, could be brain ischemia, could be cardiac ischemia. It lead to consumption of platelets, low platelets, which you have, and then signs of intravascular hemolysis, which is essentially finding schistocytes in the peripheral smear and an elevated LDH as signs of damage to the blood vessel. Damage to the red cells and low haptoglobulin. So all these things should be done. Now, remember, malignant hypertension in and of itself, as I mentioned, is a form of thrombotic microangiopathy. So we need to be very careful here to say whether it's malignant hypertension leading to everything, or is it a primary thrombotic microangiopathy or a second or another form of secondary TMA leading to malignant hypertension, right? So that's a challenge right here. So based on the labs, the chemistry, all we can say is that there's advanced kidney failure, right? We don't have a baseline creatinine. I'm sure Maddie will pull it out of, when she does her deep dive into her past history. And most likely, there would be some impairment back then, and it's worse now, is my guess. So it's not a single process. It's just a continuum. And we've got these two spikes of worsening, kidney function, likely from the hypertensive crisis. But there's probably an underlying kidney disease, is my guess, that's leading to the hypertensive crisis. Could be the other way around because, if you don't take your medications, it lead to obviously ongoing damage, right? So the quickest way to get to the diagnosis, obviously, is a kidney biopsy. But obviously, if you do that, there's nothing more to discuss, right? So we'll have to go through the due diligence of what is the workup in such a patient. With such advanced kidney failure, blood pressure out of control, and you can actually just tell us, Mary, what the cardiac workup is to make sure that beyond LVH, there's nothing else going on here.
Yeah, so her TTA was actually totally normal. She didn't even have significant LVH. Her EF was great, no signs of diastolic dysfunction. Her EF was 60 to 65%, no significant, LVH, no diastolic dysfunction, really no valve abnormalities at all. So pretty normal cardiac workup from the echocardiogram perspective.
So how would we approach this patient? As I said, the first order of business for organ or life-threatening blood pressure is to bring down the blood pressure, right? So this patient should ideally be in an ICU with an ART line, and you really don't want to drop the blood pressure by 25% and no lower than 160 in the first several hours after admission. And the reason is because of this phenomena called autoregulation. And what is autoregulation? When the small vessels see a very high or a very low blood pressure, it maintains flow by either vasoconstricting or vasodilating the afferent arteriole, right? In a patient like this, where the blood with malignant hypertension, remember there's endothelial damage. So there's no chance of autoregulation. Your flow and pressure relationship is linear. It's not like a stepwise thing. It's straight. So if you drop your blood pressure, linearly you'll drop your flow, right? Until you gain back vascular function. Then that's the reason why we do not drop the blood pressure by more than 25% in patients with malignant hypertension, even though it may be in the 160s or 170s. And this is also especially critical in acute strokes, because in fact, the stroke guidelines will tell you not to drop it below 180. It's just okay to run between 180 and 220 in a thrombotic stroke. And in a hemorrhagic stroke, you got to get it lower, of course, about 140. So she has a headache. So one thing that I'd really like to be sure is that there's no brain hemorrhage in this patient, Maddie. I'm not sure if a CT was done, and I'd like to get that out of the way before discussing the nephrology aspects of this case.
Yeah, CT had no acute intracranial abnormalities, so okay. No bleed, nothing, no muscles.
Okay, so and we have a plan for ICU admission and hopefully treating her blood pressure, but it depends on which center you're in, and a lot of times we don't, at least at Columbia, we don't have beds for days, so they'll usually get started in the emergency room itself, and by the time you the bed's available, a lot of times the patient has excellent controlled blood pressure, right? So we'll talk about the later sort of course of this patient, right? But okay, the first order of business is to quickly do three tests in rapid succession. I'd like to look at a urine analysis with micro. I'd like to look at the urine protein to creatinine ratio, and I'd like to do a kidney ultrasound rapidly. And this way we can at least get a quick differential and then plan the next steps.
Amazing reasoning sharing. I also wanted to ask you, as you were telling us about your suspicion for something like a thrombotic microangiopathy, if you're going through differentials in your mind, what should we always think of if we have something like TMA in our head as a differential?
So the first thing I would do is to make sure it's a TMA. Right now, we have only two criteria. We need the third, signs of intravascular hemolysis, right? So without sort of having access to a peripheral smear, which can be done in a minute, without having access to LDH and HAPTO and signs of intravascular hemolysis, we still cannot call this a TMA, right? But if we do, let me answer that question. But or I'll answer at the end if I haven't spoken about it yet. Is that okay?
Sure. Okay. Maddie, could you please share the next adequate?
Yeah. So I'll add a few labs to this. So just because we were talking about a hemolytic process. So LDH was 558. Haptoglobin was less than 20. And the blood smear showed actually rare schistocytes. So about one to two schistos per hyperbaric field.
Right. So we need to see a few. Okay. So there's no like hard criteria for how many schistocytes makes it relevant. Right. But clearly, there's signs of intravascular hemolysis here. So now I'm going to ask you a question, Sam. Okay. So here's the difference. My sort of personal way to look at TMA is to look at mechanisms, right? On one hand, we have what's called secondary TMAs. These are usually systemic diseases, which have usually more than one reason why the endothelium gets activated. I'll give you a short list. The most common is pregnancy, which is eclampsia, preeclampsia. That is a classic form of I wouldn't say thrombotic microangiopathy. I'm going to say microangiopathy because you don't typically see fibrin. You have a process called endotheliosis where the cells get swollen and they occlude the lumen of the microvessels. And it's typically, the organ that gets involved is a little bit kidney, but it can cause, in its various forms, the HELLP syndrome, the fatty liver pregnancy, and they're all basically the same process. The second common is infections. And the classic infection is the verotoxin producing E. coli, right? And it's called sugar toxin or verotoxin. And you can see this in epidemics or it's spontaneous in terms of tainted, fecally tainted food. And in Germany, there was a big one. It's typically O157H7, but there's another serotype, H104, something. And but they have exactly the same phenotype, right? So you have diarrhea followed by a week later by TMA. And usually kidney is the biggest organ. And then we have autoimmune diseases. Someone said antiphospholipid antibody. That's a classic. Scleroderma renal crisis. You need to look for signs of scleroderma. And rarely it can occur as part of MCTD, mixed connective tissue disease. So those are the classic autoimmune diseases. Then there's a big class called drug-induced. And the two archetypes are the VEGF inhibitors on one side, which has a much better prognosis. Then on the other side, you have the cumulative toxins like gemcitabine, right? And then we have cancer associated. So usually they're disseminated metastatic cancers that can cause essentially cancer cells within the blood vessels causing damage to the endothelium. And then finally, there are genetic causes, and the list is growing. But on the primary side, the two typical are what we call TTP. And the other one, which is being increasingly recognized, is the complement-associated TMA, CTMA, also called AHUS. The TTP is also called ADAMTS13 deficient TMA, right? So the list is really long. And the first order of business is when you suspect TMA, which as you do in this patient, there's only one diagnosis you need to rule out within 5 minutes, okay? And that diagnosis is an ADAMTS13 TTP. And why is that? Because if you do not start plasma exchange and steroids, the patient has going to have brain damage and may even die. And the reason is that you have something called a French score. You can look it up online, or something called the plasmic score. And when you look at three criteria in the French score, which is the level of platelets, typically below 20, the level of creatinine, typically below 2.2, and the presence of a positive ANA, which you don't have yet. But this patient does not have ADAMTS13 TTP because kidney function is severely impaired and the platelet count is not that low. Okay. So that is a short differential of, actually not that short, a long differential of TMA. And once you make this diagnosis, the other big entity which I told you about is malignant hypertension, right? So that's a rule out because you have to make sure that everything else is ruled out before saying, this is malignant hypertension, because everything can cause malignant hypertension. All of these entities, right? So, and that'll be your last differential once you've ruled everything. So, a lot of work to be done in this patient. Let's keep going.
Amazing differential, and thank you so much for this teaching. One last thing about the TMAs, what I want to ask you is, you also mentioned drug-induced TMAs. Which drugs should we always think of?
Okay, so the one that'll come on your boards is quinine, okay? People like tonic water, and it induces an antibody-mediated TMA, right? So quinine is a sneaky one. But the ones that are very common, there's a big list now, and I was mentioning the VEGF inhibitors, and there's about seven of them right now against metastatic cancer. And the other is gemcitabine, mitomycin C. Those are the classic ones that can cause TMA. And of course, there's radiation and things like that, but it's much, much less common.
Thank you so much. And Maddie, could you please share the next question?
Sure. Okay. I'm going to figure out which of the urine studies to start with, but I'll start with the UA. How about that?
Always start with the UA and micro, and then because you get a, on the dip, you'll get an idea of how much protein there is, okay?
So the UA, urine was clear and yellow. It had large blood, greater than 100 RBCs, greater than 1,000 protein, normal specific gravity, 6 WBCs with 5 squamous epithelial cells, negative bacteria, negative nitrites, negative leukoesterase. In terms of microscopy, it didn't reflex to microscopy, so we do not have a microscopy or culture.
Right. So, you know, we have enough data on this to say confidently that there's microhematuria, there's heavy proteinuria, and there's not much pyuria, right? So if you were to put all these together, we'll call this a nephritic sediment. It's not nephrotic because of the high amount of red cells in the dipstick, right? So when you say nephritis, now the question is there a primary nephritis causing everything, or is there malignant hypertension which can produce an identical urine exam because of damage to the microvessels, which leads to leakage of red cells and protein, okay? So hold on to that thought, and let's look at the kidney ultrasound. And did we get a urine protein to creatinine ratio, which I'm suspecting is nephrotic?
So the urine protein to creatinine was unable to be calculated.
Because it is so high.
Yes, presumably.
Okay, so vast amount of protein in the urine. Now, then you ask me, why am I still calling this nephritis, right? So the point is that we call something nephrotic, right? You basically look at, in your mind's eye, you have to look at what the biopsy is going to show. In the mind's eye, in a nephrotic patient, there's no inflammation. There's damage to the filter barrier, what we call the glomerular basement membrane. So that protein leaks out, but it's not big enough to cause leakage of red cells because there's a lack of inflammation blowing large holes in the filtration barrier. But the moment you start seeing a lot of red cells, varying amounts of protein exits. And if you have someone with, say, a normal blood pressure, you may have 1 gram of protein, but when you get the blood pressure up to, you know, 200 or you know, basically in a malignant range, this is like a hydraulic press, you know, pushing out the protein along with the red cells. So it does not exclude nephritis if you have vast amount of protein in the presence of hypertension. And usually what happens is you control blood pressure, the protein rate comes down, but you're not treating the inflammatory process that's leading to the red cell loss. Okay. So this patient in my mind is still nephritic, and we're looking at etiologies of nephritic syndrome, but this all may be from a consequence of malignant hypertension. So I'd like to know what the results of the ultrasound is.
Okay, Maddie, could you please share the ultrasound results of that?
Sure. So it's a renal ultrasound with Doppler. So the ultrasound showed a significantly increased echogenicity of the bilateral kidneys with no sonographic evidence of renal artery stenosis.
Right. So it's great you could get the secondary cause of hypertension ruled out. The Doppler is actually quite good in ruling out. It's not good in ruling in because there's a lot of false positives with it. But if you're saying that there's no renal artery stenosis, the chance of a significant, hemodynamically significant RAS is very, very low. Okay. So the increased echogenicity, all it means is that there's damage to the kidneys. The kidney size will tell you if it's acute or chronic. If it's a small kidney, you know it's all chronic. But if it's a normal sized kidney, it could be acute or chronic. The echogenicity that doesn't tell you what chronicity. Okay. So at this point in time, you know, let's pause a little bit and say, look, we have a very active urine sediment. We have heavy grade proteinuria. We have uncontrolled hypertension. We have signs of thrombotic microangiopathy. So what's the next step? So at Columbia, what we'll do is we'll control the blood pressure and arrange for a biopsy next day. Okay. Because that's the way, you know, such patients should be, because you need an answer very quickly. There are certain nephritis, which can be life-threatening if you don't get to it quickly. If it's a systemic disease, for example, onchovasculitis or anti-GBM disease. On the other hand, if it's a kidney-limited disease like IgA nephropathy, we have time. We can. It's highly likely that there won't be much resolution, even if you act very in the same day or the next day. But there are some diseases really need to act quickly. So we have to take a step back and see what's going on here. So let's see what happened to the blood pressure, how do we treat it, and then I'll tell you what we should do as a next step. Just to get it out of the way, when you look at nephritis, there's a slew of tests that we order, okay? And I'll tell you the reasoning behind it. If you look at nephritis, there are three categories. And this is just to give you a differential, a quick and dirty. When we send a biopsy to the pathology lab, the first thing that the pathologist does is look at immunofluorescence. And there are three patterns, going from nothing to minimal positive immunofluorescence. We call this Pauci immune. And the typical diagnosis is an ANCA vasculitis. The one that's very classic is linear. So if they see a nice ring-like staining on the GBM, we call this anti-GBM disease. And there's no other differential. That is the diagnosis. And if it's with lung hemorrhage, we call it Goodpasture syndrome. And then the third type, which is the most difficult, is immune complex. You see this granular deficits, right? And there are three broad, or actually four broad categories. One is called immune complex GN from a systemic disease like lupus or lupus-like. The second category is infection-related. And this could be post-strep throat or could be a post-endocarditis. Those are the two extremes that we see right now. But you can see this with any infection. And the third big category is IgA nephropathy. There are some rarer diseases, and we lump this under MPGN, but that's a bit of a misnomer. One example is C3 glomerulopathy in that group. And then finally, there's a group called monoclonal gammopathy-related kidney disease or monoclonal gammopathy of renal significance. We don't call it MGUS. And one example is what we call, it's got big names, but proliferative GN with monoclonal immune deposits, right? So that is the whole of differential. You'll hit 90% of your diagnosis in this differential diagnosis, assuming it's not a primary thrombotic microangiopathy. So your serology is really looking at complement, look at lupus and look at post-infectious. We look at the whole infection workup, if there's blood cultures, if you want to suspect endocarditis or similar, for example. If you're looking at a throat pharyngitis, syntharyngitic or post-pharyngitic GN, then you look at, you do your swabs and ASOs and such like. If you're looking at viral infections, you need a HEP panel. And we need definitely need the ANCA and then the anti-GBM and lupus serologies. And that sort of completes your serological tests.
Amazing. What I also wanted to ask is in terms of the schistocytes, in terms of the TMAs, like, is there a count of schistocytes that is usually needed, or how do you approach if you see one schistocyte?
So if you find schistocytes, you can say, so the rule of thumb is you need at least about 1/10 of the field to, if you just want to base the entire diagnosis on schistocytes. But what frequently happens is the number of schistocytes is directly proportional to how aggressive the disease is. So you can have a smoldering TMA with zero schistocytes, a slight elevation of LDH. You do a biopsy of signs, classic signs of TMA. Do a fulminant atypical HUS where the field will be full of schistocytes. So we take the whole, you know, composite of LDH. We look at to look for signs of hemolysis. And then if schistocytes are present, great. But if you meet the LDH and the hapto criteria, and along with the platelets and the organ dysfunction, are suspicions very, very high for TMA. And we'll do the workup for TMA from a, you know, clinical standpoint.
And as you said before, like said, TTP is very unlikely in this case, but would you still order a workup for the ADAMTS13 or not in this case?
Yeah, so there are rare and atypical patients with ADAMTS13 deficiency. So to be complete, you'd like to, okay, if you want to do the, you have the whole serologic workup on the secondaries, right? You'd like to do a stool toxin, all this very unlikely to have recurrent or relapsing sugar toxin-induced TMA. So I wouldn't even bother with that. And the complementopathies, it's a generic test, and you cannot get this done overnight. It has to be sent to a reference lab, and it takes about a month to come back. But we don't wait for that, because when you rule everything out and there's ongoing hemolysis and persistent thrombocytopenia, we start treatment in the absence of obviously a nephritic syndrome, right? In this patient, you know, we like to be 100% sure it's not a primary kidney problem leading to malignant hypertension, which basically means we're heading to a biopsy, okay? So, but if you had ruled out everything else and the patient had like a completely clean urine sediment, a little bit of protein, a little bit of cells, we would have said it's highly likely to, you know, going to be a complement-mediated, you know, TMA after ruling out the secondaries. And we'll start the Keolizumab and plasma exchange, depending on what availability is, right?
Thank you so much. Maddie, could you share the next other clip with us?
Yeah. So I will, I know we don't have too much time, so I'll just kind of do a quick run through. I saw someone asked in the chat about some of these serologic studies. So basically, complements were negative, ANCA negative, anti-GBM negative, ANA negative, anti-dsDNA negative. And they sent some of the more, I guess, nephrotic sort of workup. So Hep B, Hep C, HIV negative, and then SPEP and immunofixation negative.
Right. So we have a sero negative, perhaps a glomerulopathy. And the thing that stands out would be most likely IgA nephropathy given our age, if it is a primary glomerular disease, right? On the other hand, it could be just malignant hypertension causing all these, you know, abnormalities. So the moment you control the blood pressure, and typically in malignant hypertension, the moment you control blood pressure, all these signs of TMAs goes away very quickly, right? So that the acid test is that if you have persistent hematological abnormalities, despite controlling blood pressure, one should think of an AHUS kind of a situation. After having had a negative ADAMTS13, and if you're suspecting a sugar toxin situation. So that's the time when you say, look, this is most likely going to be atypical HUS when the hematological parameters don't improve. So you can just tell us, Maddie, if the platelets began to normalize after blood pressure got controlled.
They did.
Okay, so that's a nice rule-out test for atypical HUS. And now we should focus on whether it's all malignant hypertension in a seronegative patient, or is there a primary glomerular disease that is not associated with a positive serological test? And the most common disease is IgA nephropathy, given her background, okay? So it's such a big question, right? We really want to be sure of the diagnosis, and I would strongly advocate for a kidney biopsy.
And Maddie, from the next article, do we have a kidney biopsy?
Yeah, we do. But before we get there, I'll just mention one last part of the workup. So we mentioned sort of the glomerular nephritis workup. haven't mentioned the secondary hypertension workup fully yet, but it was.
So here's a word of caution, okay? Do not send renin and aldosterone levels in this patient, okay? Why? Because malignant hypertension in and of itself will raise renin and aldo levels because you have a microvascular occlusion of the kidney and you'll be fooled into thinking it's a renal artery stenosis or something of that sort. But you can send a plasma catecholamines, a plasma metanephrine with the caveat that it's not the most specific test. And in moments of stress, it can be 2 times upper limit of normal. So what did he find?
So to your teaching point, both renin and aldosterone were in fact sent, and they were both in fact elevated. Plasma metanephrines were normal. Cortisol was normal.
Okay.
So shall I bring us to the kidney biopsy?
Yeah, I think so.
All right.
People are waiting desperately for the last piece of information.
All right. Dun-dun-dun. So the renal biopsy showed diffuse sclerosing glomerulonephritis. And the immunofluorescence findings of intense granular global mesangial staining for IgA showed tubular atrophy and interstitial fibrosis and arteriolosclerosis as well. And then more microscopy stuff that I'll do that for now.
Right. So this is a classic conundrum of, who's in first? Is it blood pressure driving kidney disease or the kidney disease driving blood pressure? And at the end of the day, the best way to tell is to stick a needle into the kidney to know exactly what's going on, assuming it's safe, right? And we went through the process of the differential of if someone comes with severe blood pressure elevation and end organ damage. Now, you can, in retrospect, this is all just malignant hypertension. It's not a primary vasculitis. You control the blood pressure, see what happens. If your hematological indices get better, it's not TMA, right? So now we go into a primary glomerular disease, or it could be just a fact that malignant hypertension has left some scars in the kidney. And the pathologist is very good at differentiating between the two. As we discussed, once you have a lot of red cells and protein in the urine, that's nephritis. 3 categories, immune complex, GBM, ANCA. Send the serologies for all of these entities. But at the end of the day, even if you have a positive or negative serologies, the kidney biopsy is critical in deciding what the degree or the diagnosis is and the reversibility, which in this patient is not very good. So this patient essentially has an end-stage kidney failure because it's advanced scarred kidney. And my suspicion is it's not just four episodes of UTIs. This has been going on for 10 years where young people with a positive urine get treated for UTI and we completely miss the boat on getting a treatable condition. Misdiagnosed. So that's my parting shot is do not sort of just assume that abnormal urinalysis is a UTI, right? We have to be sure it is a UTI.
Amazing. And if you connect now her final diagnosis together with these lab abnormalities, as you mentioned before, with the low hemoglobin and low platelets, how would you connect these together now?
All right. So this is a series of unfortunate events. If you have children, you'll know that the book series, right? So it's IgA nephropathy for many years. It's an indolent disease until it's not indolent. So they may get some flares with infection. They get gross hematuria. It settles down. It happens again. If you come with gross hematuria to the urgent care and they do a dipstick, it's UTI unless otherwise proven. Okay. So you missed the boat for 10 years. I'm just going to give you an idea. As the kidneys get damaged, you get hypertension. As you get hypertension, the kidneys get damaged. In some very unlucky people like her, it goes into malignant hypertension, which she had. The moment you get malignant hypertension, it worsens the kidney damage, right? And it sets up a renin-angiotensin mediated destruction of your endothelial, layers, right? When you do that, you have thrombotic microangiopathy. If you do a biopsy, you will see microthrombi or severe endothelial dysfunction that is consuming platelets, right? It's causing the red cells to fragment. And the moment you control blood pressure, everything quietens down. But what is left is the scar from ongoing, IgA nephropathy, on top of which is hypertension-induced acute and chronic damage, right? So that's the whole package that this patient has. It's a little too late, unfortunately. She's young, unfortunate. She'll have to go on dialysis or transplant. It's not going to be a fun thing, right? Anemia is from both the destruction of red cells, we know that's happening, and the lack of erythropoietin from the kidneys being damaged, right? So I think that sort of brings the whole package together.
Thank you so much. I've learned so much. And Maddie, would you please like to share some final words about this case?
Yeah, absolutely. So Dr. Radhakrishnan really said it all exactly correct. Obviously, he's brilliant. But yeah, so, you know, she actually did ultimately go to the ICU and was treated in the ICU with a nicardipine trip. As Dr. Radhakrishnan mentioned, her blood pressure became quickly controlled. When her blood pressure became controlled, her platelets normalized, but her hemoglobin didn't. So suggesting that there was obviously some component of just like chronic CKD mediated, you know, anemia. And yeah, so she went on dialysis. Her creatinine while she was admitted peaked at around 21. You know, there's a whole, you know, later discussion for another time about sort of the indications for dialysis, but she actually really never developed any true indications for it. She was actually just initially dialyzed in anticipation for a kidney biopsy. And then, of course, as Dr. Radhakrishnan mentioned, she's still on dialysis, you know, awaiting a transplant. But yeah, I mean, I was, you know, lucky enough to you know, participate in this patient's case. Real case that I obviously thought was going to be interesting as a learning point. So I hope that, you know, the case was interesting and a learning point, but, you know, we're also super lucky to have Dr. Radhakrishnan. You know, he's one of the best, you know, that we have. So I'm glad that, you know, we could work through this case together with him as well.
And thanks a lot for the opportunity. I mean, I'm so glad this thing's happening. I think we have a nice platform for disseminating information in rare disease. IgA nephropathy is an ultra rare disease, but it's treatable. And I think as internists and nephrologists, we have to look for it and then refer them, you know, for workup and early treatment. We have not two FDA-approved drugs available that are not systemic steroids that actually works against IgA nephropathy. So it's a great era. We're also investigating complement. We're investigating B-cell therapies for IgA nephropathy in clinical trials. And it's going to go from a difficult-to-treat disease to a very, very eminently treatable disease using multiple targets.
So, Dr. J and Maddie, thank you so, so much for this incredible case and this amazing teaching. I've learned so much, like from going to secondary hypertension, the management of malignant hypertension, and then we had the TMAs and came to the whole nephritis pattern. So, so much teaching in just 1 hour. So I wanted to say thank you to both of you. And first of all, thank you so much for being here, and we hope to see you again here. And just want to ask Dr. J, do you have some final words?
No, that's what I said. But I think the kidney, like I said, is an abstract organ for many of us, right? Before we enter nephrology. And I think you have to keep our antennae up for unusual patients, you know, and it all begins with the urinalysis. It's such an easy test. Please utilize it. There's so much to do in a patient with even common garden hypertension. Just look at the urine. You'll be surprised that many of them turn out to be positive, right? So it completely changes the prognosis for a patient like this if you were to diagnose them early and refer them to us.
Thank you so much. Then I would end the session here.
All the best.
Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
All right. Ciao.
Bye.
That's a wrap, folks. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
If you like this episode and want more from the Clinical Problem Solvers, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter that includes episode recaps, teaching points, and educational graphics.
And if you'd like to join us live, check out our daily virtual morning reports, where we come together as a global community to discuss cases and learn together. For more information and instructions for signing up, check out the link in the episode description.
See you next time.